I'm your host, Dale Schirbeck, and welcome to the HQ Podcast. For those tuning in for the first time, the HQ is a podcast serial produced by CHA Learning, and it's your trusted source for important conversations on healthcare issues and topics from those that are leading and impacting the health system. Together, we'll explore these topics as we continue to learn together. CHA Learning is a professional development division of Healthcare Can, and is uniquely Canada's only national fully online learning provider serving all of healthcare. So please check out more about our learning programs and services after this episode and discover how we collaborate with health leaders and organizations like those we feature on the HQ to empower healthcare professionals with the knowledge, skills, and relationships to impact health system improvement. So thank you, listeners, for joining me today for another amazing conversation. And I dare say that burnout was once, not that long ago, a dark secret that many, if not most, carried in silence and alone. So little did we talk about it that it seemed a rare thing that made having it all the more wounding. But as Christina Maslach and Michael Leiter write in their 2022 book, burnout is among the most significant on-the-job hazards facing workers today. It is also among the most misunderstood. In particular, we tend to characterize burnout as a person issue, a problem employees should fix themselves by getting therapy, practicing relaxation techniques, or changing jobs. Not surprisingly then, with many healthcare professionals choosing to do the latter, people leaving their jobs is partially contributing to a system in crisis, and those that continue to work in the healthcare find themselves increasingly overwhelmed and facing threats like moral distress and unrelenting demands, and so the cycle repeats and grows. How then can we address this pernicious issue that threatens individuals, those served by it, and the sustainability of the healthcare system itself? Is it a problem of knowing what to do? A problem of resources? An issue of values and culture? Something else? Some would definitely argue that many healthcare professionals fundamentally know what they should be doing to take care of themselves and where to go to get help, but they don't as they put the care of others ahead of themselves. If that is the case for most, then how do you get past simple get-well fixes that are themselves somewhat tone-deaf to those in distress? To discuss this, I'm very grateful to be joined by Dr. Dana Lee Bagley, a registered clinical psychologist with training and expertise in clinical psychology, health psychology, and organizational psychology. She herself worked as a health psychologist for almost 15 years in multidisciplinary teams on medical, surgical, and cancer care hospital units with patients with chronic and life-threatening health conditions. She is an internationally recognized expert in acceptance and commitment therapy. She also conducts research at Dalhousie University and St. Mary's University, and she has an active research program on behavior change, obesity, chronic disease, burnout, and professional resiliency with 55 peer-reviewed publications and over 140 scholarly presentations. She is the author of the book, Healthy Habits Suck: How Do You Get Off the Couch and Live a Healthy Life, Even If You Don't Want To? And the co-founder and the chief scientific officer of the Impact Me app, a science-based workplace wellness app. Hi, Dana. Welcome to the HQ, and thank you for helping us navigate this difficult topic and perhaps provide some help and hope and guidance to the many who are in need.
Thank you for having me.
So, as I describe in my introduction, you yourself were once a healthcare provider in the system. So maybe you can just start there and give us a bit of, of your backstory and tell us about your background and what led you to your current work.
Yeah, so I'm a health psychologist primarily. That's what I've spent most of my career doing. So working on medical units in multidisciplinary teams. We were doing work on, burnout and resiliency for healthcare workers even before the pandemic. I was still working there for wave one and wave two of the pandemic. I left after wave two for my own burnout reasons. And also that I'd spent a lot of time sort of fixing up the individual and then sending them back to toxic workplaces. And so I wanted to spend some time fixing the toxic workplaces instead. And so that's led me to what I do now, is helping workplaces come up with more comprehensive mental health strategies that address, a more systemic issues than just the individual.
Thanks, Dana. So I guess the crux of this is this sort of, pull between two different sides, I guess, as it were. You know, on the one hand, and, you know, we're in a moment of significant transition in healthcare today. We're trying to transform a system that has been toxic at times or underserving certain parts of our population, for sure, emphasizing new values and maybe, you know, challenging that they themselves may be challenging to some. And there's lots and lots of projects that are being implemented at the same time to try and improve on these things, which are putting more pressures on our people as well. So how do we help and support professionals who themselves may be depleted and yet on whom so much depends, really, and helping these organizations, undertake the transformation that we need?
I really think organizations in general and healthcare specifically need to think about their employees and their staff as their most valuable resource and to be investing in them. And so when we talk about burnout, we see, you know, these problems that arise by focusing, I think, too much on what the individual should do. And as you mentioned, the research, on burnout is that burnout's a mismatch between the employee and their workplace environment. It was never meant to be a medical diagnosis that an individual person should hold. And so we talk about that in terms of like the burnout burger, which that there's an individual that is squeezed between cultural and organizational factors that also influence burnout. So you mentioned, Dr. Maslach and Leiter, their new book, they have this great quote in there where they talk about canaries in the coal mine. And so again, canaries in the coal mine were there to warn the miners that the oxygen was being depleted and that they needed to, get out. But no one ever said that the canaries should be more resilient. And yet somehow that's what we've done with burnout, is to suggest that the healthcare worker needs to be more resilient and that they need to do more things. And so we've taken a different approach. So for example, we got funding during the pandemic to do a burnout intervention with frontline workers. And I was a frontline worker at that time. And I was like, we are not telling these people that they just need to do more yoga or like meditate more. And so we did leadership training, which is one of the ways you can address systemic causes of burnout. And so we trained leaders on things that they should do to address their own burnout and things that would reduce burnout in their employees. There's actually a number of different factors that research has, identified that are workplace factors that would influence it. And so we did that, we did three randomly controlled trials with that, including with physicians, leaders during the pandemic, and showed that we could reduce their burnout as well as reduce their resting heart rate, which is an involuntary indicator of stress. We did it in very real life conditions. We have weekly data where we actually show like, here's where wave three hit of the pandemic. And the study showed that people who were in the active treatment were protected from the increase of stress caused by wave three. And so that's about, helping leaders change the culture through role modeling, as well as address some of the systemic causes of burnout so that it's not just on the shoulders of the individual, that we're not just trying to make the canaries more resilient.
So what are some of the examples, I guess, that you would be looking to, I guess, develop in those leaders that help in that space?
Yeah, so we talk a lot about role modeling behavior, and that's a way of changing culture. And so, we talk to leaders about how they need to be explicit about how they're recharging their battery. So we talk about recharging your battery instead of self-care. We try to normalize that everybody needs to recharge their battery, right? Yeah. But we need to be more intentional about it because there's so many new stressors and, drains on our batteries. And so we talk about how leaders can be explicit in role modeling that, what kind of messages they're sending, do we reward people who worked overtime, right? These kinds of things. And then for the workplace factors, there's workplace factors like workload, which everyone thinks about, but there's other workplace factors as well, like autonomy and control, fairness, recognition and reward, community and connection, and values alignment. So there's actually a number of different things that organizations can do that will impact kind of everybody. And so often, workplaces kind of say, oh, we have a mental health strategy. We have an EAP. which is great, have an EAP. But that's once the crisis has happened. And we know there are a ton of barriers to help seeking. Organizations are missing an opportunity because they're relying on their employee help seeking behavior rather than finding other ways that would impact everybody, right? So we talk about, how do you put fluoride in the water? How do you change the workplace so that it's healthier for everybody and doesn't rely on help seeking behavior? And then you can also have, you know, those resources for individuals who need that in a crisis, but get more upstream by training leaders about how they can address these, you know, workplace factors that we know from research impact burnout.
Yeah. So, I think that, you know, part of what you're describing also in that modeling, I mean, that themselves is perhaps a challenge for some of our leaders. So, I mean, I know that one of the conversations we've had on the podcast has been around, you know, vacation time, for example, right? And sort of this, another sort of, I guess, moral distress about people feeling guilty about taking vacation while others are working harder, so they don't. You know, delaying vacation as a reward, as perhaps a, instead of as a mitigation strategy to getting ill. But with our depleted workforce, it's really hard for people even to take that time. So, I mean, what are your thoughts on that, or maybe other examples that you might want to share?
Yeah, I mean, I think this, you know, one of the things that we talk about with leaders and with employees is about disappoint them now or disappoint them later. A lot of workplaces, including healthcare, have this notion that you can just keep pushing people and that it will work, that you somehow can just keep pushing them and bad things won't happen, or that you can just somehow fill the spots, right? So again, I worked in healthcare. I had many managers who would say, oh, there's just a lot of turnover in healthcare. Actually, there doesn't need to be a lot of turnover in healthcare. People are not spending any effort on retention strategies. It's a huge cost to the system to have to like find people, recruit them, train them, right? Just to have them leave. And so, you know, those are like, again, cultural kind of ideas about that you can just keep pushing people and there's no consequence to that. And so, you know, you either disappoint them now, meaning that you put boundaries in now about what you can do or not do, and you go on vacation, for example, which means that for a week, patients are not being seen, or you disappoint them later, which means that people end up burnt out, they quit the profession, and now nobody can see somebody because that healthcare position is gone, right? That healthcare provider is gone. And so disappoint them later is always a crisis and always worse, but it actually requires us to tolerate some distress to disappoint them now. Right. And so, again, as a healthcare worker myself, you know, it was the idea like, do I take a sick day today and cancel the six patients I have today? Or do I keep pushing myself and then have to take a week off because I get sick? Right. Disappoint them now or disappoint them later. But either way, you can't keep going. The, you know, part of the problem with healthcare workers, ironically, is that they're so resilient, right, that they can keep going at such high levels of burnout that they will just keep pushing themselves instead of trying to fix the system. They'll just keep compensating for it. And so that was like a lot of the work we had to do with healthcare providers is, how do you not save the system so that the system itself can get fixed? And yes, patients get harmed in the short run, but we are not better off now because people waited this long before trying to tackle these issues, right? This is, we're in the disappoint them later. And it's scary to be a person trying to access healthcare in Canada, right? Because we know the resources aren't there and the healthcare workers are not there.
Yeah, to some degree, I think we take advantage of or take for granted, right? The passionate commitment that our workforce has to the profession and to the system and patients and families. So, but it, you know, they're human beings with the same needs as everyone else. So, so maybe, I mean, you talked a little bit about, you know, some of the factors that we're facing as we, you know, facing burnout. Do you want to expand on that a little bit further or discuss more of those in more detail?
Yeah. So for example, you know, people think about workload and they sort of immediately think, oh, that means not seeing patients and increasing wait times, for example, right? But both the Canadian Medical Association and the American Medical Association have talked about like paperwork, right? Like, as like a burnout mitigation strategy of how do you reduce unnecessary administrative burden? How do you get rid of things that we actually don't need? And again, organizations are great, and hospitals in particular, of making more and more forms that you have to fill out, right? But not cutting back on forms, not decreasing the forms. This one maybe isn't needed anymore, right? And so, you know, there are a number of initiatives across Canada of governments and hospitals looking at unnecessary paperwork that you could actually eliminate, right? As a way of not just not seeing more patients, but actually as a way of reducing burnout, you know, for physicians, for example, or healthcare workers. So there are those kinds of things you can think about in terms of workload. It's not just seeing fewer patients, but there's other things as well, like, you know, recognition and reward. So for example, do people get acknowledged for their work, right? We have a tendency again to only focus when things are going wrong and to only acknowledge when things are going wrong versus when things are going right. There's other aspects like fairness. And there's a number of different forms of fairness, which is called justice in the research literature. And so for example, there's, you know, procedural justice, which is like how a process gets decided. There's, you know, the outcome of it. Did people think it was fair who, you know, who got the promotion, for example? But then there's also like informational justice and interpersonal justice. Like, how do people get information? Does everyone get the same information about what's happening? How are people treated as part of the process? And so I really think that like leaders and managers have not been well trained in people skills, right? And so often managers become managers because they're the best widget makers, for example, right? But then you become a manager and it has nothing to do with widgets anymore. It's all about people. And we really have not equipped leaders and managers with these people skills to handle these things. And so they're faced with enormous, like, you know, issues of like mental health problems and suicidality and, you know, all of these things that they are not equipped to deal with, and that we really should be training leaders to have these skill sets. Again, there's a ton of psychology we could be using to help them understand how to manage people. And I think those skills are lacking, not because they don't want them, but because we haven't been thoughtful about training people in those kinds of skills.
Yeah, or the focus is on productivity or achieving results, right? As opposed to the humanity and compassion components of, you know, what it takes to for a team to be able to accomplish those things.
Ignoring the fact that if you treat people better, they are more productive, right? Again, seeing those as separate things that are somehow like, if you treat people well, that's like the opposite of productivity. They're all related to each other. When people, you know, one of the things we work on with workplaces, psychological safety, right? Which is there's physical safety, but then there's psychological safety in terms of like, you know, your spirit or your emotions or your heart or your mind. Are those things safe at work as well, right? Having psychological safety helps people cope better, right? So one of my favorite, you know, stories is there was research that they did where they had people stand at the bottom of a hill and estimate how tall the hill is. And if you're standing there with loved ones, we will estimate the height of the hill as being less than if you're there all by yourself. Then they have studies where they have people carry a backpack and estimate the weight of the backpack. And even though they're not allowed to help you, if you're with family members, loved ones, we will estimate the weight of the backpack as weighing less than if we're there all by ourselves. Then they have some studies where they have people on a functional MRI and they administer a standardized shock to their toes. And so you can see the pain receptors of the brain light up on the fMRI. And if you're holding the hand of a loved one, your pain receptors do not light up as much as if you're there by yourself. Now, if you're holding the hand of someone you have a distressed relationship, it's actually worse than being there all by yourself. Because it's not about being with someone no matter what. This is about the benefit of like safe, trusting relationships. But when we have that, the obstacles don't seem as big, the burdens don't seem as heavy, and the pain doesn't seem as bad. We haven't changed anything in those circumstances. We have just tapped into the way humans function, that when you feel like someone has your back, life feels more manageable. And so helping workplaces create psychological safety improves productivity, right? Because people see those challenges as more manageable, right? And it's also like good for their own well-being.
Yeah. And then one of the, what social determinants of health is social connection and family, right? So I think it's a great example in terms of how that is just as relevant in our workplaces too. So
yeah, again, we have this like outdated kind of view of that there's like your personal life and then there's your professional life and they're somehow totally separate and you can pretend to not be a person when you show up at the workplace. But that's not how humans work. They show up as like the messy, flawed humans that we are, right? And we need skills to help people understand how to manage messy, flawed humans who are not logical creatures, who do not just do what you tell them to do, right? But again, there's a ton of psychology that we can use to help people, you know, have different conversations with people that then improve these relationships and improve, you know, things like psych safety in the workplace.
Yeah. So maybe moving in from that, Dana, you know, so there are lots of tools, obviously, for managing stress and improving mental health and wellness. I mean, you've talked about yoga and, right, you know, meditation, deep breathing, right, hydration. I mean, sure, we all know what most of those things are, you know, but, you know, why isn't it as simple as just telling our healthcare workers, you know, to do those things, right, to breathe mindfully or practice some of these other behaviors in their spare time?
Yeah. Well, one, they don't have that much spare time, right? So if you talk to healthcare workers, they are, you know, working a lot of overtime, all these things, again, because there's not enough people to run the system. And again, most people know what they should do. The challenge is actually getting people to do it and to stick with it long term. So when we work with the individual, the thing we're focused on is the how of change, not just the what of change, right? And so again, there's a ton of science of behavior change that we can help people use to find more time in their day, to be able to replace that with recharging activities, to make that, you know, one of the key questions we ask people about recharging is who benefits if you're more charged, right? Because we get caught up in this thing about I'm being selfish, right? This is time away from my family. It's time away from my work. But actually, if you are more charged, everybody that you care about and all the things you care about and probably all the people you interact with are going to benefit from that. It's actually not just for you. And so we have this notion that we have to convince people to put themselves higher on their own priority list. It's usually a tough sell, and it's a tough sell in healthcare workers because they've been trained for decades to not put themselves first, right? Yeah. And so instead, we want to link it to the things that are already at the top of their priority list and show them that recharging their battery is in the service of those things. Right? That's why you're doing it. You're doing it for your patients. You're doing it for your family. Yes, you'll benefit, but all these other people will benefit as well. But then I think the second thing is that we need to stop doing so much about the individual and again, change the workplace, right? Train leaders to have the skills to address, you know, the systemic and cultural factors in burnout so that it's not just on the shoulders of the individual, right? That we're tackling these other things. That again, there's a lot of science that we could be applying here. People don't need to like reinvent the wheel or come up with new things. We know a bunch of the things that we can already be doing.
And just to be clear, I guess, so it's not an either or though, right? I mean, people still need to practice, you know, good personal behaviors that, you know, are modeling self-care, but creating a safer, more inclusive workplace is going to contribute to those things having perhaps better impact or reducing the harm itself.
Yeah, I think when people know that you're trying to tackle the systemic causes of burnout, they're actually more willing to invest in their own self-care as well, right? When healthcare providers continue to get the message that it's all on them, that they're just not doing enough self-care, right? They don't want to do it, right? And they face a number of barriers. We did a study with Health Canada on mental health resources for healthcare workers during the pandemic. We did a survey and a lot of the feedback was, I don't even have time to do these things. It's time, you know, how am I going to find time to go for a therapy appointment? How am I going to find time because I've been asked to do all this overtime and nobody is letting me take time off, right? So I remember somebody asked me once about like, how long does it take to recover from burnout? Right. And I was like, well, if you go back to the same workplace that was causing your burnout, then I don't know why you think it's going to stop, right? Again, you can't just fix the individual and not change the environment that they're in and expect them to get better. And so we want to do both, right? We always talk about empower the individual, empower them with science-based information that is about them working smarter, not working harder. Mm-hmm. Just try harder is not a science-based strategy, right? And then also target these cultural and systemic factors so that it's all working together. And I think that makes, you know, individuals more willing to put in the work for themselves when they know that their workplace is targeting these other factors as well.
Yeah, and I think, I guess that's part of also, I mean, you talk about rewards and recognition, but I think perhaps historically, right, some of those rewards and recognition, whether it's, you know, even in the form of chocolates in a coffee gift card or something, in the absence of organizational change may feel insincere or incomplete. So I think it's perhaps, I guess that's part of, I guess, connecting those two things together and what you're describing is the more holistic sort of approach to wellness or retention, even if we might put it in those terms.
Yeah. And again, we often reward people in healthcare for working overtime, for taking on more patients, for staying late, right? That's the cultural part of healthcare that makes it very difficult to engage in self-care, because all the recognition reward is about not sleeping and putting your patients first and doing all these things that harm your health, but help the patients. And that then, you know, is, if that's what people are getting rewarded for, that's what they're going to keep doing. But you put enough stress on them and eventually everybody, you know, gets burnt out. And what happens in healthcare is that they leave the profession, right? They don't just take time off. They often like leave the profession entirely.
Mm-hmm. So earlier in our conversation, you talked about justice and fairness. And so maybe just coming back to that a little bit, Dana, you know, what is the relationship, I guess, between health and wellness and, you know, justice, equity, diversity, inclusion, and why is behavior change important to consider in relation to these JEDI efforts?
Yeah. So when we think about things that can be drains on our batteries, social determinants of health are a big one, right? If you have housing insecurity, financial insecurity, those are big drains on people's batteries. And again, we have this tendency to focus just on what the individual is doing and sort of ignoring the, you know, social factors, the cultural factors, the other things going on in their lives that influence it. We used to see it all the time when people were trying to, you know, make changes because they had a chronic disease. They get diabetes, for example, and they need to make these lifestyle changes, and they're being told they need to eat more vegetables, but they live somewhere that where there's a food desert and there's no vegetables in any close proximity, mm-hmm. right? Even things like go for a walk and de-stress. Some neighborhoods are not safe to go for a walk in, right? And for lots of racist reasons, it's not safe for some people to go walking, right? And so we need to take those things into account if we really want people to be well, and addressing those factors can help people be well. And so I think one of the limitations of the way we're, you know, working on diversity and inclusion right now is that, again, we haven't embedded the science of behavior change. And so what we need is people to change their behaviors on a daily basis in terms of how they interact with other people. And so, again, the work that we do with organizations on JEDI work is about changing behavior and how do you sustain that behavior. Again, finding value-driven reasons for change so that it's not a check-the-box activity, that's something that you keep doing. Finding ways of, you know, behaviorally describing what it looks like. So we tell a lot of people what not to do, but that's not the science of behavior change. You want to tell them what to do instead, right? So clarifying the do instead behaviors, having a way to acknowledge mistakes, right? We need to be able to make mistakes as we're learning. And so we need a way to communicate that. So often it's about giving teams language about how they can talk about making mistakes when they misunderstand each other, for example. And then understanding the internal things that show up, like biases that are just part of human brains. And so we can't change the biases, but you can change your behavior, right? You can recognize when the biases are influencing your behavior and choose more inclusive behavior instead. And so again, I think this is part of, you know, what's lacking in a lot of interventions for this now is that, again, we haven't made that training into something that is about behavior change and a more lasting effect.
Interesting. So I'm just wondering, you know, as bringing some of this together in terms of how does what you've been describing here impact on a sense or a person's individual sense of belonging, I guess, within an organization, and how does that contribute to, you know, managing burnout or mitigating it in the first place?
Yeah, so we know that belonging is like a fundamental human need, right? Basically, humans over time have always needed other humans to survive. And so the forces of evolution, you know, were not person versus person. They are actually tribe versus tribe. And that's why humans have so many social emotions that are about having the tribe survive and not just the individual survive. And so we're hardwired, right, to feel better when we feel connected, to safe trusting other people, and to feel distressed when we don't. And we see this in like the loneliness epidemic, for example, right? That loneliness can be just as harmful for your health as smoking, for example, because it's a very, you know, hardwired thing in humans that we need to feel connected to other people. And so having a sense of, you know, inclusion or belonging in the workplace involves both feeling welcome, so feeling like you belong, but also that you can be your unique self. And so it's those two aspects that, you know, define inclusion, is that I feel welcome, and I feel like I can be myself. And so again, that's the same hardwiring that we talked about earlier, about that that changes our perception of the world and makes us feel more capable of doing things. And if we were training people, leaders, for example, teams, for example, to focus on these kinds of skills, they're not things, you know, that take a lot of money, for example, to do to help people feel more included in their workplace, but they have a dramatic impact on people's well-being. And so that includes both, you know, patients as well as healthcare providers. I used to work with a lot of medical residents, and they were experiencing a lot of discrimination in the workplace, you know, and so it's not just patients that are being impacted by these things, but also healthcare providers are being impacted as well. And so these are the kinds of, again, psychological knowledge that I think we possess, but we haven't translated properly into the workplace. We haven't translated that into actionable, implementable things that we could do that would, you know, improve people's lives.
So taking all that together, Dana, I guess as we sort of come to a bit of a close, but I mean, what would be your guidance to healthcare organizations in terms of where to make investments or change? You know, because we've talked about lots of different things, and that there's certainly a responsibility within organizations to create these spaces. But so where do they, you know, where do they put their money?
Yeah. So if I was an organization, I would focus on leadership training because it's your fastest way of making systemic change. There's other things you want to do to make systemic change, including policies and, you know, other, you know, structural things like hiring practices, things like that. But you can have the quickest effect if you're training leaders, and leaders themselves are also burnt out. And so giving them the skills to that, equip them with the skills that they need also helps their well-being, right? And I would also encourage organizations to think like, is what you're doing actually science-based? There's a lot of training and stuff in workplaces that has no science behind it and has no validity to it. So even when we talk about Myers-Briggs, for example, there's no independent evaluation of that. So they probably have a huge database of, you know, information, but there's no independent verification of that. And no other scientist studies those personality dimensions besides Myers-Briggs. And so, you know, are we actually using things that are science-based, that are theory-based? I think that's both the responsibility of researchers to translate their work faster and more efficiently and more, you know, so it's more useful in day-to-day basis, but also for organizations to think about whether there's any science behind what they're doing. Because there is science that we could be using. It can help leaders, and that will have an impact on their employees as well.
Thank you. Great wisdom and certainly opinions that I share. So in terms of the importance of developing leaders. So any other words to you then, Dana, in terms of bringing this full circle?
Yeah, I would just say that, you know, part of one of the other reasons that I left the hospital after wave two was that, you know, I was doing therapy with one-on-one therapy with cancer patients, which is clearly a meaningful thing to do, but the mental health needs of the planet had like exploded. And for me, I was like, this is, you know, this isn't going to cut it. One-on-one therapy works great, but it's not going to meet the needs that are out there. And so from that point forward, I really focused on what can I do to make science more accessible? What can I do to increase access to science-based misinformation. And so that's a lot of what we've tried to do, is really translate our research into practical, scalable things that people can do, you know, every day that can help them. And so these are not, you know, skills that are going to treat mental illness, for example, but they are skills that would help a lot of people suffer less and understand more about how humans work and how to have their interactions and you know, with other people and how to improve their lives. And so I think that is both the responsibility of researchers to make sure that their work is being translated into useful things that an everyday person can use, as well as organizations in being thoughtful about, you know, what they're purchasing and what they're investing in.
Yeah. Thank you, Dana. And I think I would, you know, iterate, I guess, that, I mean, I appreciate that you yourself have, you know, helped in translation of that and into clear language specific comments and topics here that I think any of our listeners should be able to sort of take and move with, and, you know, and to investigate some of them in more detail in terms of what they can do to invest in themselves to make some of these things happen. But you've made, I think, the topic a lot more accessible and real and given us some clear advice in terms of places that we can act and make a difference.
Yeah, well, thanks for the opportunity to, you know, this is now part of my values and how I want to contribute to the world is it's really in a big scale to help reduce human suffering, but on a day-to-day basis about how do we increase access to science-based information so people can live more meaningful lives and flourish more. And, you know, I have a deep love of the healthcare system. It really was a challenge for me to leave the healthcare system. I applied for several more jobs that were totally inappropriate for me just to stay being a healthcare worker. And finally, I was like, all right, I just need to go do something else. So we really would love to work with healthcare organizations, and we just find that they're in such crisis right now that they can't get ahead of it. They can't get beyond the crisis to do something proactive. And so it's really hard, you know, to shift those things. But I think individuals and leaders and organizations need to be, again, value-driven about what kind of environment they're trying to create, what kind of world they're trying to create, so that they can make some of those hard choices that, again, might be hard in the short run, but create a more sustainable system in the long run. We do not have a way of having a sustainable system.
No, and I think the you know, perhaps part of the challenge that we're obviously that we're facing is that the scale of the problem seems somehow overwhelming for lots of people to be able to tackle it. At the same time, the scale of the problem is perhaps focused our attention on the issue more than it's ever been before, because it's not a new problem. And more resources are being put into this than we've ever seen. So, you know, I'm hopeful, right, that people are now talking about the issues that need to be talked about, and that we are going to start to see incremental change, perhaps contribute to wholesale system changes down the road.
Yep. There's a definition of hope, which is, you know, wanting a certain outcome to happen. And there's a definition of hope, which is belief in the possibilities. And so it can sometimes be tricky to have hope when you want a certain outcome to happen, like this change must happen in the healthcare system. But we can have hope about the belief in possibilities that maybe, you know, as things deteriorate, it actually gives us options to create brand new things in their place, to not be doing band-aid solutions, but to make more change because things, you know, are so stressful in those environments. And so we could have that, you know, belief in possibilities that we can make it something that's healthy for everybody.
Yeah, I'm not sure if it's Einstein or some other thoughtful leader, right, that talks about that, that hope is a moral imperative of all leaders, right? So, and so without our leaders having hope, then really, where else do others sort of draw that strength from?
Yeah. And, you know, we talk about, because it can kind of feel like a bit of an apocalypse, you know, which is not the end of the world. Apocalypse meaning a time of great change, right? But it's especially important to think about who you want to be in the apocalypse, right? It's especially important to think about what you want to contribute to the world and how you want to show up and how you want to take care of other people, right? And if we could change those thoughts about, you know, healthcare workers being the most valuable asset and what we need to do to protect them rather than putting patients first, that actually would result in better patient care. It would result in better outcomes for patients. right? And that you can make those changes, you know, we talk about like on a daily basis about making changes. All those things really do add up, and then get together with other people who believe the same thing so that you're working together with other people to make change, right? But we absolutely can make change. And you know, the pandemic was obviously a really stressful thing, but also showed us how we could pivot and do radically different things that we had never done before, right? Just because we decided to do them. And so we need to take that same spirit of thing, like we can do things radically different, and we're completely capable of it, right? We just need to be headed in the right direction about investing in people first.
Wonderful. So yes, I think Every crisis obviously presents us with a glass half full, half empty sort of opportunity. And I think that you've shared us with us here, certainly as a close here, you know, how that glass is half full and the opportunity to do so much more. So thank you again for a wonderful conversation, uplifting, and hopefully it inspires the change that we all want to see.
Thank you for having me.
Bye-bye. You've been listening to The HQ, and I'm Dale Sherbeck, your host. You can find this and other future episodes on the CHA Learning website, Apple Podcasts, or Spotify. We'd love to hear what you think, so please follow us on our other social media channels. Thanks for joining us in this discussion today. Please join us next time.